So you can look at your specimen on a carbon film. That has pluses and minuses. First of all, on the positive side, you have a nice background from which you can ascertain the level of defocus and do corrections for the contrast transfer function. On the negative side, the carbon in the background adds noise to the image, and although you can get rid of that noise by averaging, it's best not to have it perhaps there in the first place. The other option is to use wholly carbon films or fenestrated films, and that's very popular. Just have a hole in the carbon film. There's carbon around the hole, and maybe even plastic. The liquid is a thin film across the hole in which your specimen is embedded. The background is low. Usually you can set it up so that when you take an image, you get some carbon film in your image as well as the hole. So you really have the best of both worlds. You can ascertain the level of defocus and do corrections for the contrast transfer function based on what you can get from the carbon film. And you have a nice, clear image with very low background over the whole of your specimen. Here's an example of the sort of image or the sort of low mag image you'd get with these quantifoil grids. These are made by a company in Germany. And these holes, I think, are 2 microns in diameter, and they're spaced center to center 4 or 6 microns. I don't remember which it is. But these are very beautiful films for cryomicroscopy. They're particularly good for automation because you can predict where these holes are going to be. So 2 microns is quite a nice size for taking a picture, I mean a piece of film, at about 35,000 to 40,000 magnification, because the film will cover this sort of area here. You will get the entire hole. You can see your specimen in the hole, and you can get some information about the defocus and the CTF from the carbon around the hole. The other thing is that when you want to take a picture there, you have lots of area around it to do your focusing, astigmatism correction, and wait for the drifting to stop. So many people are now using these quantifoil grids. You buy them either as plastic, to which you can add your own carbon, or you buy them carbon-coated. They vary from batch to batch. Some of them, you need to be careful of this, have a lip around the hole, which makes the ice layer in the hole very thick. Some of them are rather dirty, these dirty ones can cause quite bad charging effects in your images. You can also make holy films yourself, and I think in the practical today we'll have set up a demonstration where you can see in the light microscope what these look like and what homemade ones look like. Homemade holes are not as regular. They vary in size and in shape and in distribution, but you have control over making the grids, so they tend to be cleaner. So the next problem is, once you've decided what sort of grid and what sort of support you're going to use, how do you make a thin water layer? And that, it sounds easy, you know, the water won't spread thinly, because most of the supports that you're going to use, in particular carbon, which has been aged for anything from a couple of hours to a couple of days, is particularly hydrophobic. And the water does not want to spread out on that. So you have to actually do something to your supports to enable the water to spread thinly. One of the earliest methods, which was taught to us by Bob Glaser's lab, Jules Jaffe and Bob Glaser's lab, was to use this sort of double carbon film method, where you sandwich your specimen and some liquid between 2 carbon films, and then you wait for an unspecified amount of time, and then you plunge this sandwich into a cryogen and freeze it. And this was very successful for a number of years. The methodology that is in general use now was initially developed or discovered by accident in Jack Dubochet's lab, and that is that we now tend to glow discharge. Dubochet originally did it, glow discharging in an atmosphere of amyl amine. There's a lot of argument about why amyl amine works. I have no clue why it works, but it does tend to work. The amyl amine is actually not necessary. Just glow discharging your carbon films right before you're about to make the specimen is usually sufficient. There are other ways to make the water spread, and that is you manipulate the surface tension of the water with detergents or denatured protein, and then there's the process of blotting. You can make, which I'll talk about in the following slides, and then you can make thin water layers by spraying your solution onto the grid. So this is a double carbon film method. You have a support film on a copper grid to which you add your specimen. You have a second carbon film floating on the surface of a container of water. You take your specimen, your grid with the specimen on it, dunk it quickly into the water and pull it up through the second carbon layer, and then you can blot off any residual water on the back. And then generally what you do is you watch it until the surface of the grid on this side loses its sheen, which means that the layers are getting very thin, and theoretically, when it's something like this, you would plunge it into a cryogen and freeze it. So this has quite a few limitations. There may be total loss of the specimen during this step here. It relies on evaporation to get the layer very thin, so you have absolutely no control of the ionic environment. And because you're losing specimen here, you may need a large amount of specimen. The surface treatments are to circumvent this problem here. Carbon films, when they're freshly made, are somewhat hydrophilic, but as they sit around in the lab, they're like activated charcoal. They tend to pull things out of the air, and labs are not very clean places. There are usually vacuum pumps around. There's usually oil in the air. And these contaminants come down onto the surface of your carbon film and make it extremely hydrophobic. And the water, if you put water on it, it will not spread out into a thin film. It will round up into these large lumps. And I'll show you some pictures of those a bit later. So fresh carbon combined with glow discharging or affecting the surface tension with denatured protein or detergents is the way which is used usually to make these thin layers, and you get your specimen, instead of in a large blob of water, you get your specimen spread out in this thin film of water. Okay, so now we have a thin layer. How do we freeze the thin layer? And what are the sort of considerations that we need to take into account while we're freezing the particular specimen? So first of all, we'll talk about freezing sprees, cryogens, types of ice obtained, and then control of the actual drop environment itself. So liquid nitrogen, which is the most common cryogen found in a lab, is actually a very bad thing to freeze your specimen in because, as you well know, if you can take liquid nitrogen and you can pour it onto your hand, and your hand is perfectly fine. And that's because liquid nitrogen boils, and you get this insulating layer between the nitrogen itself and your hand or your specimen. And so the freezing rates obtained with liquid nitrogen are actually quite slow. And you need fast freezing rates to enable you to get vitreous ice. So the nitrogen boils around the specimen, and you get very slow freezing rates. You can't get many of the cryogens that were used years ago because they contribute to the ozone hole. And so over the years, people have looked at liquid propane, which was a popular cryogen, and also liquid ethane. Both of these are very good. If you take a container of liquid propane or liquid ethane and pour it onto your hand, you will be severely damaged. liquid propane has one disadvantage in that it's quite sticky. So if you drop your grid into liquid propane, and then take it out to transfer it into nitrogen, you'll get a glob of liquid propane around the grid, which will then, when you dunk it into liquid nitrogen, freeze around it. So that's the main reason that we don't use propane. Ethane does not suffer from this problem, and it's an excellent cryogen. The problem with ethane and propane is that there's quite a large difference between the boiling point and the melting point. So you will see today that we have a container of liquid nitrogen in which is suspended a smaller container of liquid ethane, and the ethane is condensed from a gas tank into that. The liquid in there can be at any temperature between minus 88 and minus 172. If, however, you plunge your grid into liquid ethane at minus 88 degrees centigrade, you will not get amorphous ice. It needs to be at a much lower temperature. It needs to be down towards this sort of temperature. And the way to ensure that is to cool the ethane with a piece of metal that's been cooled in the nitrogen, stir that around in the ethane until the ethane gets cloudy, and then it's getting close to its melting point. These gases are very dangerous. When you're using them, be very careful. Be particularly careful if you live in an environment where the humidity is low, because as you're walking around, you can build up charge, and then this charge can be, you'll get a spark as you come up to your ethane container, and then it will explode, and that will be the end of your career. It also has an odd property that it seems to expand when it goes solid. So if you're not careful in adding nitrogen to the container in which your ethane container is suspended, and the nitrogen boils over into the top of the ethane will solidify and explode up through the solid layer formed on the top and really damage you. So be very careful when using liquid ethane. So blotting. Blotting is a learned art. There are now machines that do blotting, and one of those will be demonstrated today. These machines tend to be very expensive. I think the Vitrobot is $60,000 or $70,000, so you may not have one available in your lab. So for the most part, blotting is done manually. And put very simply, what you have is a grid with about 4 microliters of liquid on it, and you take a piece of Wattman number 1 filter paper, and you push it up against the grid, and then you look for some sign that a thin layer has formed. Then you take the paper away, and you plunge it into your liquid ethane. And one of the signs that I found is quite reliable is to look for a break in the contact between, so this crude diagram represents the grid here with the support film, and this is the liquid, and this is the filter paper. So when you first apply the filter paper to the grid, you get this connection between the grid and the filter paper through the water. Then the water is wicked away by capillarity, and the filter paper is pulled in towards the grid. And then at some point, the capillarity pulls away sufficient water that this contact breaks. And it's at this point that you should freeze the grid. A lot of people simply slap the filter paper onto the grid and then count 4 or 5 seconds and then take it away and freeze it. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But the speed with which this liquid is wicked away depends upon the viscosity. So if you have a very concentrated solution of your macromolecule of interest, and sometimes you'll be freezing things at 10 to 20 mg per mil, counting is insufficient because it will not have had time to wick away. Freezing tubulin, and we've done this in the past, at 20 mg per mil, you have to keep this filter paper on for 15 seconds until this contact breaks, and then you can freeze it and you'll get quite a thin layer. So what are the concerns about the type of cryogen and the speed with which freezing is carried out? Well, if you freeze things slowly, so if you put some water in your ice box at home, you get hexagonal ice, which is the familiar type of ice. It's highly crystalline. It's large crystals, It's the stuff you put in your scotch. And what happens with slow freezing is in a liquid represented here in this square with some biological material in it, is that you get nucleation of ice crystals, and those ice crystals grow larger during the freezing process by recruiting only water from the surrounding liquid. So over here, where it's completely frozen, what you have is a large single crystal of ice, and your biological material and all the salts are squeezed into this glue between the ice crystals, which is referred to as the eutectic. This principle is actually used in the food industry. In Florida, where they grow oranges, they squeeze the oranges and then they slowly freeze the orange juice. And what you get is large chunks of pure water and this eutectic here, which is concentrated orange juice, which they take out, package up in these little containers and sell in Vons. So there is some relevance to the real world for slow freezing. At intermediate freezing rates, which you will generally get if you plunge your specimen into liquid nitrogen, you get cubic ice, a different crystalline form of ice from hexagonal, and this is characterized again by nucleation. There tends to be a lot more nucleation here in the liquid, and the growth of very small crystals of this cubic ice. At very fast freezing rates, essentially you get vitrification. And here you get amorphous ice. This is structureless ice, and this is what you're aiming for. So this is what you'll get if you freeze in propane or ethane slush. This is usually what you'll get if you freeze in liquid nitrogen. If you freeze in nitrogen slush, which some people have done in the past, you will sometimes get this as well. This is what you get if you're really bad. Okay, so another consideration is you have your specimen on the grid, you have your 4 or 5 microliters of liquid there, you have blotted it, you've taken the filter paper away, and there's a finite amount of time between taking the filter paper away and that grid falling into liquid ethane. And you have to consider what's happening in that time. Well, what's happening is that there's evaporation of the water from the surface of this thin layer. And you might think, well, that's no big deal, you know, it's not going to affect it. But in fact, it is going to affect it. And some calculations which were done by Ken Taylor in 1976, which he gave to me many years ago, demonstrate that very dramatically. So today, the humidity in San Diego is probably about 60%. The temperature is around 25%, 25 degrees centigrade. And under those sorts of conditions, normal lab conditions upstairs today, where you will see the grids being frozen, you're losing 817 angstroms per second from the surface of your thin film. So if you're trying to make a thin film which is 500 to 1,000 angstroms thick, this is a big problem because it takes perhaps a quarter to a half a second to get the grid from where you have it, where you've just taken the filter paper off to the liquid ethane. You can get around this by raising the humidity and lowering the temperature. So we tend to make frozen grids in the cold room at 4 degrees C with a kettle boiling in the cold room to keep the humidity up, and the humidity is generally at this sort of range here, and that allows these evaporation rates to be severely reduced. One of the most telling experiments you can do, if you don't believe me, is to get some myosin thick filaments, which are very sensitive to changes in the ionic strength, and try and freeze those at room temperature. I guarantee it that you will never see a thick filament, because while you're freezing the grid, you're getting so much evaporation. Someone's nodding here. You're getting so much evaporation, the ionic strength is going up, and the thick filaments are falling apart. You will only see thick filaments if you freeze under these sorts of conditions. Okay, so now we have it frozen. We've been very careful. We've considered evaporation. Actually, there's one other point that I wanted to make here. So I've talked about the fact that the solutes are concentrating here, and that can be a big problem. You've lost control of the ionic environment if you're not careful about evaporation. The other thing is that while things are, as water is evaporating from the surface here, this liquid in here is lower, it's cooling. It's getting less than the ambient temperature. And you can demonstrate this very easily if you take an EM grid, put 4 microliters of liquid on it, and stick a tiny thermocouple in it. You'll find that if the room temperature is 25 degrees centigrade, the temperature recorded in your drop of water on your grid is about 5 degrees lower than that, and that's because the evaporation is having this cooling effect. So if you're working with a specimen which is temperature sensitive, you need to take this into consideration. A number of years ago, we did some experiments with Eckhart and Eva Mandelko, who are interested in the dynamics of tubulin. And tubulin, or microtubules, grown from pure tubulin, are very sensitive to changes in temperature. So at 37 degrees, they tend to assemble. If you lower the temperature from 37 degrees, they tend to fall apart. The purpose of the experiment that we were doing was to visualize what was happening at the ends of the microtubules as they were growing and as they were shrinking. It was very easy to get them pictures of them when they're shrinking, but it was very difficult to get pictures of them when they were growing. So we didn't realize that evaporative cooling was taking place, so we thought, okay, well, we'll just, you know, go into a warm room at 37 degrees and we'll make some grids. And we found out in the end that the temperature of the drop in the warm room at 37 degrees was about 34 degrees. And that was sufficient to prohibit us from seeing these protofilaments, these straight protofilaments at the ends of growing microtubules. How we had to do the experiment in the end was to boil a kettle in the warm room and raise the humidity to close to 100%, and then we got the result that we wanted. Unfortunately, it was a very uncomfortable experiment to do. Okay, so we have our thin film. We have it frozen in the amorphous state. Do we need to worry about keeping it in the amorphous state? Yes, we do need to worry about keeping it in the amorphous state. So how stable is amorphous ice? So here are some graphs, which I think are from one of Jacques Dubuchet's publications, about the transition between vitreous ice, which is the one you're interested in, and cubic ice, which is quite damaging, and between cubic ice, which is damaging, and hexagonal ice, which is also damaging. So temperature along the bottom, the time for the transition from vitreous to cubic here, you will see that the transition, if you put a vitreous specimen in the microscope and raise the temperature of the cold stage to minus 130 degrees centigrade, it will change from vitreous to cubic incredibly fast. With lowering temperature, this slows down, and at the temperature of most cold stages, which is about minus 180 degrees centigrade, vitreous ice is stable. You will never see the transition between cubic and hexagonal in the microscope because at these sorts of temperatures where the cubic to hexagonal transition occurs, the ice sublimes in the vacuum of the microscope. So if you put a grid in the microscope and you see hexagonal ice, you've put the hexagonal ice in there. It hasn't transitioned in the microscope. So you have a frozen grid. You tend to store them under liquid nitrogen, and then you have to mount it in this cold stage, and the mounting is done with the cold stage mounted in this cryotransfer unit. This is the Gatan system. The end of the cold stage where the grid is positioned is kept under liquid nitrogen. The grid is transferred in here in a small grid box. It's then put in the end, and this is taken. Cold stage, as you'll see in the next slide, is quite well designed, and there's a protective shield which protects the specimen as you're taking this out of the transfer unit and inserting it in the microscope. So the cold stage itself, the standard one these days, has this end dewar where there's liquid nitrogen. There's zeolite in the bottom, which when it's cold acts as a local cryo pump. This dewar is evacuated usually to a pretty high vacuum, which increases the stability of the whole system. There's a rod down the center, which allows the heat here to be dissipated to the cold nitrogen. And the grid is out here, and as I said, there's this control for putting a slider, where is it, cryo shield, pushing it forward to cover the grid while you're inserting it in the microscope. So once it's in the microscope, do we get the ice subliming in the microscope at the temperature at which we're interested in? And here's a graph again from, I think, one of Dubuchet's publications. Evaporation of water in a perfect vacuum as a function of temperature. And here's the temperature, minus 90, around about minus 100, minus 104 degrees C. The rate of sublimation from the surface is about 10 angstroms per second. And this was known for many years from, or qualitatively from people's experience in freeze fracture, where I told you they would freeze their specimen, slice it with a knife, and then sublime away some of the liquid in the fracture unit. If you keep your specimen below 120 or so, you essentially don't need to worry about the ice subliming in the microscope. Do we get condensation in the microscope? Do we get contamination in the microscope? And the answer is, without some sort of protection in the microscope, yes, you get terrible contamination. And that's because your specimen, without any protection, is the coldest thing in there. And although you have quite a good vacuum in there, there's a lot of crud floating around in that good vacuum. And the crud sticks to the cold area, which is your specimen. So your specimen acts as a local cryo pump, and you get a buildup of contamination on your specimen. With an anti-contaminator, and most modern microscopes come with an anti-contaminator already built in, the contamination is minimal. This is an old-style anti-contaminator designed by Jean-Claude Omo in EMBL. This is now largely superseded by what the microscope manufacturers provide. So how do we know if we have the right kind of ice in the microscope? Well, each type of ice has its characteristic electron diffraction pattern. Hexagonal and cubic ice are crystalline ice, so they have variations on some sort of crystalline diffraction pattern. Hexagonal ice tends to form these large crystals, so if you hit the electron diffraction button, you'll see a beautiful, very strong, single crystal electron diffraction pattern. Cubic ice tends to form as very small microcrystals, and they're all in different orientations to each other. You hit the electron diffraction button on your microscope, and you will see a powder pattern, these very sharp rings in electron diffraction. Vitreous ice, amorphous ice, as the name implies, is structureless to a large extent, and you will see very broad rings at characteristic spacings. So that's, in theory, what you see. In practice, it's very easy to recognize these different ices. So over here, large single crystals of hexagonal ice. Here, a field of very granular looking cubic ice crystals. And here, a field in this particular area of amorphous, well-frozen liquid. The characteristic sharp electron diffraction and powder pattern of these microcrystals and the very broad diffuse rings, which are characteristic of an amorphous solid. I didn't put a diffraction pattern in here. They're very strong spots. These dark lines across the ice crystals of hexagonal ice are very characteristic also. They tend to move around under the influence of the beam, and they're called, I think, bend contours. And they're caused by diffraction spots being excluded by the objective aperture. And under the influence of the beam, the crystal bends and warps, and different reflections are excluded by the objective aperture and don't contribute to the image. But these are very easy to spot. This is also very easy to spot. In the early publications of from Dubuchet's lab, when they came out, I must confess, I wasn't convinced that they had amorphous ice, because like the story with Aaron Klug and Nigel Unwin, this looks like carbon film. But when you see it in the microscope, it's very clear when you have amorphous ice. Again, this is from Dubuchet's lab. Here's the large single crystals of hexagonal ice and the characteristic diffraction patterns that you'll see. Here's the granular appearance of this cubic ice. It's microcrystalline, so you get this powder pattern here, amorphous ice, with these very broad, diffuse rings. A large grid square here with a dry area and an area where there's a large expanse of amorphously frozen buffer. And again, the electron diffraction pattern. These are homemade holes, and this is quite a good grid square. This is microtubules. Those of you sitting at the front will probably see the microtubules running across these holes. Many of these holes are thin enough and suitable enough for recording images over. This is really a very nice grid square. This is not so nice. This is thick ice, so one would guess that this carbon film was not very hydrophilic, and the water sort of bunched up and formed these thick layers. So this is probably a couple of thousand angstroms thick. These holes are all unsuitable for recording images over. However, if you look around, you'll find the occasional hole, which is thin, and from which you could record an image. This is a really bad grid square. There's no ice in any of these holes. It's not printed very well. It looks like there's ice there, but in fact, there's no ice anywhere. You can see the microtubules here in the background. This is probably a very hydrophobic grid. A word about expectations. You will be very disappointed if you put your grid in the microscope, open the shutter, and expect to see something like that. This is perhaps a tenth of the surface area, or a thin, well-frozen area like that is perhaps a tenth, if you're lucky, 20% of the surface area of the grid. A lot of your grid will have broken grid squares, really thick ice, no ice at all, and a small percentage of the grid squares will look like this. But you don't actually need a large number of grid squares. 10 grid squares is probably sufficient to collect an enormous amount of data. Just quickly running through some typical pictures. This is a virus, LCMV, very large virus. I think this is about 1,000 angstroms. I can't remember what the scale bar is. Heavily defocused image and a image which is closer to focus but not yet at focus. Here you can see these sort of spikes sticking out of the membrane very clearly. Over here, the people at the front can perhaps see the bilayer of the membrane at this particular defocus level. Here was an experiment that I did many, many years ago. There was when I was working on ribosome crystals. So here is a picture of a well-frozen ribosome crystal. The ice is amorphous. This is an electron diffraction pattern from an area not on the crystal, but off the crystal. So what I did was record this nice picture, which diffracts very well, and then I allowed the cold stage to warm up. At about minus 130 degrees centigrade, we got the transition from amorphous ice to cubic ice. You can see the aspect of the background changes from this featureless background to this sort of sandy, granular background. You get ice crystal nucleation in the biological crystal, which does a certain amount of disruption. And the diffraction pattern, the electron diffraction pattern, changes from this amorphous-like pattern to a powder pattern of sharp rings. And then warming up from minus 130 to about minus 90 degrees centigrade, the whole thing freeze-dries. Note that we don't go through the transition from cubic to hexagonal ice. It freeze-dries directly from the cubic phase. And here you see the sort of damage that's incurred by crystallization within the confines of the lattice, of the ribosome crystal lattice. Here's a nice ribosome crystal in amorphous ice. Featureless background here. Nicely preserved with an optical diffraction pattern of an area here, which extends to what in those days was a very good resolution, about 50 angstroms. Joachim will show you tonight much better data. Mark Yeager showed this last night. This is actin filaments, which are fully decorated with the head portion of myosin. And you can see that, well, perhaps you can see that they form these sort of arrowheads, which on this particular filament are pointing in that direction, and in this particular filament are pointing in this direction. It's kind of funny, you know, when you go out to give seminars to people who don't know about cryo microscopy and you show them this wonderful picture and they go, what? It's like, it doesn't look very good, but it's the sort of picture that makes us really excited. So by image analysis, as Mark showed last night, you can derive a tremendous amount of structural information from images like that. Another example, microtubules. Again, the background is really quite featureless. These are all these pictures, this picture and this picture is the biological material over holes in the carbon film. So the background here is really very clean. There's no noise contribution from the carbon itself. Positive contrast in the image. These are well preserved to about 20 angstroms resolution. And again, the sorts of three-dimensional maps that you can obtain from these data. So I think I'll stop there and ask for questions. Okay, so the transition here, from here to here, is between amorphous ice and cubic ice. You will see that in the microscope if your stage warms up to about minus 130 degrees centigrade. The next transition, which is between cubic ice and hexagonal ice, you will not see because as this warms up, it sublimes directly from the cubic phase. This is an academic point, but it's useful because when you put your specimen in the microscope, and you see hexagonal ice and you go, well, where did this come from? Well, you know that it can't be because you warmed it up in the microscope. You've messed up at an earlier point. This sort of information is good for troubleshooting. There was another question? In my experience, these things don't have a large effect. I mean, we have frozen things in buffers which range from basically distilled water to half molar potassium chloride with the same degree of success. You will run into problems if you're handed the specimen or if you store your specimen in like 20% glycerol. That's a big problem because it's very viscous, so it'll be hard to make a thin film to begin with. And secondly, it's a problem because 20% glycerol, even if you manage to get it frozen very well, will lower the contrast because the glycerol, as far as the electron beam is concerned, is the same electron scattering as protein. So you want to stay away from things like glycerol or sucrose, which are traditionally used to store your molecule of interest in the minus 80. Other things that we've noticed are not good to have around are some organics like DMSO. So microtubules are sometimes polymerized in the presence of DMSO, which predisposes to certain protofilament arrangements that we're interested in. You kind of need to wash the microtubules to get rid of the DMSO before freezing them, because if you freeze 5 to 10% DMSO, it seems to damage much more quickly than just buffer. You know, you have a microtubule frozen in 10% DMSO, you flash the beam across it, and it's basically bubbled already. Don't hold me to that. These are sort of anecdotal things that we've noticed over the years, but there are these idiosyncrasies of the freezing and imaging process. breath. Brad's referring to a recent paper from Dubuchet's lab, wasn't it? I think it was from Dubuchet's lab where, I mean, traditionally you hold the grid vertically in tweezers and you plunge it vertically into the cryogen. And very elegant experiments from Dubuchet's lab with fast photography shows that what happens when the grid hits the cryogen is that the surface of the cryogen sort of goes like this. And they hypothesized that one could get much faster freezing rates if instead of plunging it in like that, one plunged it in flatly. And very pretty elegant paper. We really don't see that this is a problem. I mean, it's pretty successful. No, that's, I would say that's not really a consideration. I mean, the choice of whether you use a carbon support film behind your specimen or whether you do it over holes is actually a very personal one. the carbon film can be made thin enough and clean enough that it doesn't contribute a tremendous amount of noise. And, of course, with averaging, you can get rid of that noise anyway. The contamination issue on carbon, if you're careful, is not a big deal. Sometimes you have to use a carbon film simply because your specimen will have such an affinity for the carbon that it just won't go into the holes. So there are some specimens which, however hard you try, you'll never manage to get them in a hole. And then you have to use carbon. I mean, if people are concerned about the amount of noise that's contributed by the carbon film, you can make incredibly thin carbon films and lay them on top of a Holy grid so that you have a little bit of support over the hole and to which and a support to which your specimen will adhere. And also, that little bit of carbon will give you enough signal to see the tone rings and to get the contrast transfer function accurately. Bob? Yeah, I mean, that's an argument. I mean, that's a practical argument for putting it on a carbon film. I don't know why some things stay out of the holes. We had an instance recently in the lab of a cage-like molecule made of DNA, which really would not go into the holes and had to be done over carbon film. Some people prefer to image over holes. Some people prefer to image over carbon. It really comes down to personal preference sometimes. Now, negative staining. This is a technique that a variant that Dubuchet also introduced, and the idea, if I'm correct, was to use 10% solution of, what was it, ammonium molybdate, and to freeze the specimen in that. And what you get is apparently a very well-preserved specimen with very high contrast. The considerations, the initial considerations or criticism of that was that this is really good for getting extremely pretty pictures, but people were unsure, and I haven't followed up, I must confess, people were unsure how to deal with the images computationally because the low-resolution information, the outline of the specimen, is essentially there in negative contrast, and the high-resolution information is there with positive contrast. So at some point in this, you know, the Fourier transform, the contrast flips, and I haven't followed up, so I don't know exactly what the outcome was. Andy, you want to comment? Oh, this one? Yeah, so Andy's point is that these tubes here, the stain appears not to have penetrated the vesicle, whereas here it does seem to have penetrated the vesicle. Chris? Here? It looks like the stain has gotten... Oh, you mean the whole thing has sort of come down, and that's also possible. That would be difficult to tell the difference. I mean, Andy's suggesting that the stain gets inside the tube, and that's why we see this line here. And Chris is suggesting that this has sort of collapsed down, and there's a sort of depression on the surface, which the stain has sort of pooled into. So the question is, how do you make the water level, the water layers across holes of even thickness? One relies on luck, I think. That's the sort of quick answer. I mean, it's the sort of thickness is determined empirically. I mean, with experience, I mean, I've given you a sort of guideline and told you, oh, freeze your grid when the contact between the filter paper and the grid breaks. Well, that's a rough guide. You know, you may find with your particular specimen or with large holes that as the contact begins to break is when you need to freeze it, or with very small holes or with a viscous specimen, you may need to wait until the contact is completely broken across the entire grid before you freeze it. So there's that sort of, you know, 1 to 2 second variation in where you choose to freeze the grid. And I can't really tell you, I can't give you a recipe. It's something that you have to figure out from experience with your own specimen? Sorry. I suspect it's because some charge is imparted to the carbon phloem itself, although I don't know. Does anyone know why glow discharging works or how it works? Everyone's shaking their head. I told you, this is not a science. This is an art. Yes, if it's sufficiently long time, your carbon phloem will be gone. I mean, it depends on the violence of the glow discharging as well. You know, if you have a glow in there which kind of looks fluorescent, you know, like day glow purple, 30 seconds you're filming. But, you know, a weaker glow, you can do it for longer time. It's not really a big problem. I mean, you have to violently glow it to get rid of your carbon phloem. We've actually only had it for a short time, and I haven't experimented with it. Those that have experimented with it in the lab are mixed in their opinion of it. Some people run screaming from it and say, oh, never again. And some people really like it. So, and there are some groups, I mean, Ava Nogales' group love it. I think Wachu's group are very much in favor of it. I had an embarrassing experience in the early 80s with that. We've been working to get frozen hydrated pictures, and I got this beautiful picture one day which actually diffracted incredibly well, and I printed it up and showed it to a visitor to the lab, and he goes, "It's the wrong contrast." And it's exactly as Bob said, it had dried out and become negatively stained by the salts in the buffer.
Evaluation forms are on
think it might be the battery because of the light.
No, but Brian's a brand new battery.